This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for spending your Christmas Eve with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you haven't finished up your Christmas shopping yet, there's a good chance you are on your way to the mall right about now, or you're in the parking lot trying to find a way out. Our next guest says there's a gloomy reality, though, that we're not talking about. The fact that many of these malls themselves will soon be shutting down. And it's not just for economic reasons, though that's part of it. Joining us now is economist and historian Neil Howe. He's the president and founding partner of Life Course Associates. He wrote an op-ed for USA Today called "Are Malls Becoming Extinct?" Neil, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, do we have that right? A lot of malls are going to be shutting down soon?
Well, they've already been shutting down. There's actually only been one mall built in the United States since the beginning of the Great Recession. And in earlier decades, as many of us remember, earlier in the post-war era, every year we were building sometimes hundreds of malls across America. By one estimate, 1,000 of America's 10,000 malls will be shutting down over the past over the next decade, from now until the mid-2020s. And there's actually, if anyone's interested, there's a website called deadmall.com, which just has nothing but kind of gloomy, gothic pictures of all of the shut-down malls across America, the ones that have already gone out of business. So it's a reality that's already in play, and now we're really sort of investigating kind of why it's happening and where malls are going.
We'll tweet that site to Central Time WPR, the deadmall.com site. We'll put a link there. Well, let's talk about why you write about economic and cultural reasons. Let's tease out some of the economics here first. We, every year around this time, we in the media obsess over holiday shopping numbers, sales numbers, but it's not one size fits all. Malls, in particular, are seeing worse sales. They're in more dire straits than the rest of the stores out there. Is that right?
Part of the story with malls is kind of the story of our overall economy and society over the past decade. Particularly if you look since 2007, 2008, there are some malls which continue to do well. And in general, they are the malls which, before the Great Recession, were selling the most per square foot. In other words, these were the most successful malls. These targeted generally consumers in the, $100,000 plus income bracket. Those malls, on the other hand, that did not do that, that were on the other side of the economic divide, have done worse. And obviously, we've got a lot of Americans who've doing a little bit less, shopping at the Gap or Penny's or Macy's and doing it at Walmart and other places, which were probably less likely to be in malls. So part of this story is an economic gap. Part of the story, though, is generational and an age gap. Increasingly, malls are targeting not only an affluent consumer, but an older consumer. These are often boomers or even, the pre-boomer silent generation, who generally are pretty well off today. And they were used to they're very used to going to malls. The first malls started up among much great fanfare as the symbol of America's future in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And these are generations which have very positive association with malls, and eventually, of course, raise their kids in malls. So there's a story too of what's happened to the economy. I would say that The generation that probably was most greatly influenced by malls in their childhood is probably Generation X, mm-hmm. Born in the 1960s and 70s. And by that time, malls were being turned into kind of experience lifestyle centers. You didn't just shop there. You danced. You went to movies. You entertained yourself. And these kids spent a lot of their childhood hanging out there. Very interesting. Two things are happening. X's, as they are growing older, and of course now Generation X are now the, parents and, on the verge of midlife now, and they are the major retail shoppers. They are economically hard-pressed, and they are moving, of course, to digital. They're moving to the e-tailers. They're moving to the power centers, the factory outlets, the category killers. So they're moving to places that either can, you know, a physical place that can, that's really not so much a mall experience, but a lowest priced experience, where they're moving to, you know, they're moving to Amazon and all the e-tailers.
I want to jump in on the generational story for a minute, though. I mean, you mentioned my generation, Generation X, spending time at malls, and it was an activity. Going to the mall, it was a bit of a drive for me. It was in a rural area, but it was a thing people did. The teenagers met up in a mall and hung out there all day. Whether or not we bought that much is another story. You say that's going away with current generations, even going to the mall to not spend money.
That's going away for millennials. In other words, the kids born since the early to mid-1980s, these younger kids now even in their 20s, spent much less of their childhood in malls. And in fact, you can actually see this. If you're interested, this is part of the Monitoring the Future project, which actually has been asking this question of high school seniors since the late 1970s. And actually, there's about one-third decline in the share of kids who say they frequently go to malls. There's about a 50% rise in the share of kids who say they never go to malls. Part of the issue now is that kids are busier now. They don't have time to hang out at malls. They're busier studying. They're busier with their scheduled activities. And their parents are much more protective of kids. You know, a lot of Xers hang out at malls because their kids really didn't care where they were during most of the day. That's really changed now that Xers are parents, right? And who absolutely want to know where their kids are every hour of the day. So that's part of the interesting change here is that the younger people are going less. You know, the youth, teens, early 20s are going less to the malls, even while the parents themselves, for economic reasons, are kind of shifting their own, buying patterns elsewhere.
So you mentioned part of that money now for the Generation Xers and our offspring is going online, and part of it is going to the big box stores. That seems like it's taking over the physical and economic real estate that the malls used to occupy. Can you talk about that transition a little?
Yeah, and that's a big war going on now because, of course, the big box stores are themselves under attack, waging a desperate war of survival with the e-tailers. So you see, Best Buy Best Buy is obviously still around, but some of the others like Circuit City have gone down. These used to be and still are what we call category killers, right? I mean, they're these huge stores which have all kinds of stuff in them. But they are feeling the heat, and this is the war of what's called bricks versus clicks. And for a long time, it was thought that these big physical stores were doomed, but now they're beginning to fight back with in-store analytics and all kinds of ways of offering you promotions and so on your cell phones and giving you all kinds of special ways of analyzing how people move around in their stores. It's interesting now the physical stores now have ways of actually tracking what's going on with shoppers inside their physical, retail outlets in ways that allow them to gain some of the informational advantages that the Amazon.coms had. But it's a brutal contest between these two. Malls are kind of out to one side. I think malls are becoming increasingly, again, lifestyle centers. They're focusing more on things that you have to be there to do things, cutting your hair, getting a doctor's visit. They're even leasing spaces out now to churches, art shows, walkathons, bands. So increasingly, the mall is a place where you do things, again, where your physical presence is required. In my opinion, the long-term future of the mall in the hands of the millennials will be turning malls back into sort of almost quasi-community centers where we do community-oriented things. And it's less a place where you buy and sell, more a place where you do things together or have services provided for you, often in groups, where you just got to be there.
It sounds a little like what a lot of downtowns were trying to do when their business was taken away by malls, trying to make themselves gathering points and community events to try to lure people down there.
And to some extent, that's working. That has worked. And you see one of the biggest gains in real estate construction, housing unit construction, are multi-unit dwellings in core urban areas where a lot of young people are flocking, young professionals are flocking. Just look at the incredible boom in micro apartments, for instance, sort of, gentrified micro apartments where young people don't have to have cars and they can move in and they can work there. And I think that helps. There will always be a place for the mall, though, because it's either inner or outer suburban, and these are places where people will raise their families. The one problem with core urban areas is that people always associate them. Even though these urban areas are much safer than they used to be, the crime rates are way down, most people don't want to raise families there. So they will move out to do that. So I think you will find some renaissance in sort of these neo-urban, mixed-use inner-city areas. But I think you will also see this new concept of the mall. Again, less oriented toward just, picking up all all the stuff you need, and more oriented kind of revitalizing a real sense of community. And I think that is something, by the way, that millennials really are looking for. If we know anything about them and their attitudes toward what they want in America for the future, it is a greater sense of community. And you certainly do see that in their voting behavior, among other things.
We're talking with Neil Howe about the future of the shopping mall, and we want to hear from you. Do you still shop at the old-fashioned shopping mall? What about it keeps bringing you back, or why don't you go? And are you one of these people who grew up hanging out at the mall with your friends? Do you drop your kids off there now? Would you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Neil Howe about the tough outlook for U.S. shopping malls. Hundreds of them, he says, expected to close over the next decade. And we're taking your calls, too. Do you still go to the mall? Why or why not? Do you have fond memories of shopping there, maybe when the malls first came into being, or hanging out as a kid, as a teenager? Do you take your kids there and drop them off and let them hang out with their friends like we used to? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Neil, you mentioned earlier, one of the exceptions is the upscale mall. Can you paint us a picture of what kind of stores are there, what the experience is like for these malls catering to people earning in the six digits?
Well, these are, we have a great example in the greater D.C. area, which is Tysons Corner and Tysons Galleria. I mean, these are the Nordstroms and the L.L. Beans and we all know what brands are being sold there, and they're trendy, they're high status brands, and again, the typical customer is older. The typical consumer is older. I think one of the things that people don't realize is happening in America today is that wealth and income is, they're kind of generational drivers for this, but wealth and income is shifting up the age scale. So, it's one of the most notable findings of the Fed Survey of Consumer Finances that came out in 2010. It was for the first time households in the 75 plus age bracket, this 75 plus, had the highest median net worth for the first time ever. Back in the 1960s, this age bracket had the lowest. So you can see there's a shift. We see a record number of grandparents taking over custody for their grandchildren. They're paying for the extended family vacations. They're starting college trust funds for their grandkids. They have a lot more money to spend, and they're looking at their kids who don't have as many jobs, don't have as many opportunities. Interestingly, since the last peak of employment at the end of 2007, and I think that month was something like November or December of 2007, the overall economy has lost 3 million jobs, but that's 6 million job loss under age 60 and 3 million more jobs for people over age 60.
Wow. Right?
So these are boomers who are just aging, working in place. They're not retiring. And they are increasingly the ones going out. They're eating out. They're They have expense accounts. They're going to the restaurants, the better restaurants in the mall. They're buying stuff. They're buying stuff not just for themselves, but for their kids. And as you know, a lot more of these 20-something kids are living at home in multi-generational families, right? That is also returning to America today, partly because in some cases their kids can't find jobs. I think in some cases because they simply get along really well now. Boomers get along very well with their first wave millennial kids. They often watch the same movies, listen to the same songs, wear the same brand name clothing. So I think you're seeing a real shift from what we used to consider the traditional pattern, which was, you know, older people aren't as well off, younger people, you know, prime age, working adults, you know, went to the malls, did all the shopping. All of that is really beginning to shift. And I think this is anyway particularly interesting for Gen Xers. I don't know, many of them may recall kind of a film producer, Kevin Smith, Rob. I don't know if you remember,
sure.
But produced the movie Clerks and then Mallrats. You remember Mallrats?
I do. I want to jump in, Neil, because we've got full phone lines and not too much time left. We've got Jack
Go ahead.
Jack with us in Eau Claire. Jack, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. It's interesting. I'm a 70-year-old male, and so I've experienced the whole gamut of the malls. And at one time, when they first arrived and prospered and grew, they were great shopping destinations. And, of course, as you guys mentioned, they became social centers for kids later on. Now, for me as a 70-year-old, they're just a great place to go and get walking exercise in the winter. They're not a shopping destination at all because the digital age has changed all of that. From my perspective, you go out and find what you want on the internet, refine what it is with its features, and then search for where you're going to get the best deal, whether you want to pay shipping or if you can find it locally in some store. It doesn't have to be a mall where you don't have to pay shipping and taxes are cheaper.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Jack. Neil, a common story there, I bet.
That's the nightmare of all the brick-and-mortar stores. It's called showrooming. And you walk in and you look around. You see all these. You can actually pick up and feel and look at all these interesting electronic products that we'll be looking at. Then you whip out your cell phone and you look and see, gee, I wonder where I can buy this cheapest. So the ultimate horror story are the reports from many stores that people are actually buying the product from Amazon or from an e-tailer. Well, they're actually in the store handling the good that's on the shelf, right? So,
we'll go back. Thanks for the call, Jack. We've got Tom in Madison now. Tom, hi.
Hi. I guess my comment is basically, or question is the same as the previous caller. And I work part-time at a retail store in a mall. And what I hear is that what the retailers are pushing for is more online sales, so they don't have to pay their employees to sell and pay them commission. And that we would end up just being there to show people products. They would go home and buy them online. I'm just wondering what you think of that, and I will hang up and listen.
Interesting. So the store is trying to drive online sales from their own online entity there, Neil.
No, and I think that's true. One of the problems with bricks and mortar is that it's obviously very expensive to actually maintain a store, a physical store. And if you're also right, if you're playing commissions to actual store people and all that, rather than just having it all digital, how do you afford that? How do you afford all that extra money from a business point of view that you're spending? One of the things you do is you can offer extra in-person services. For instance, if you take a look at stores now that are offering electronic products, this is, for instance, what with the Geek Squad, for instance, at Best Buy. But for instance, you offer all kinds of ways of helping people install products. You recommend, you know, ideal ways of putting systems together. You try to leverage as much as possible the advantages of the personal experience and the personal advice and counseling. And arguably in the area sometimes of, you know, setting up a home theater in the electronic area, that can actually work. And there's stores that make that system work. But it puts a tremendous pressure on other stores. I think the other thing you can do as a mall is make it an experience to give you other reasons to go there. But again, it's very hard to prevent people from actually going in, looking at the product, and buying it elsewhere. In terms of lack of taxation, as you know, the federal government is moving to sort of level the playing field. Now, increasingly, you do have to pay taxes. That's been a big fight, which Amazon is basically throwing in the towel now. Basically, Congress has said, well, wait, Amazon, as long as you do any business at all in these states, you know, even have a representative, you know, even come within this geographic domain of the state, you are doing business in it, and you have to pay state taxes, you know, retail taxes on the sale. So I think actually that battle is being lost. And so to the extent that these e-tailers have a tax advantage, I think within the next 5 years, we're going to see that largely disappear.
Neil, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. That's Neil Howe, president and founding partner of LifeCourse Associates. He wrote an op-ed for USA Today. It's called "Are Malls Becoming Extinct?" Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at archiving and scrapbooking. That's coming up after 4. Coming up next, the 10-year history of StoryCorps. Stick around. More to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, I'll talk with the practical archivist about the best ways to preserve our photos. First, a few months back, we spoke with Dave Isay on the show. We're going to revisit that conversation now. Dave is the founder of the popular StoryCorps program, which just celebrated its 10th anniversary. He joined us to talk about some of his favorite memories from the last decade, and I started by asking him about what StoryCorps was all about.
Well, StoryCorps launched 10 years ago. A very simple idea. We started in Grand Central Terminal. We built a booth where you can bring anyone who you want to honor by listening to their story. It could be a parent, a grandparent, friend. You're met at the booth by a facilitator who works for StoryCorps, who brings you inside the booth, and then you sit across from, say, your grandmother for 40 minutes in this kind of sacred space. The lights are low, complete silence, almost like a recording booth. And the facilitator's in the corner, and it's kind of a method as best possible to distill your life in 40 minutes. Very intense conversation. At the end of the 40 minutes, two CDs have been burned. One goes home with you, the other stays with us and goes to the Library of Congress, so your great-great-great-great-grandkids can get to know your grandmother through her voice and story. And excerpts, of course, are played every Friday on NPR, on Morning Edition, on Wisconsin Public Radio. And we have books and animations and all kinds of other stuff. We recently did our 50,000th interview,
wow,
which makes it the largest collection of human voices ever gathered, with about 100,000 people, because most people come in pairs. But I think we're just getting started with StoryCorps. As you know, and listeners know from listening on Morning Edition, it's a project that's about a lot of things, mostly about listening, but about finding the poetry and grace and dignity and beauty in the stories all around us when we take the time to listen. And our goal is to help to make that part of the fabric of this country at some point. So we've got a long way to go.
And at that opening day you mentioned 10 years ago, I think I read that oral historian Studs Terkel was there. Can you talk about how he helped at least to influence this idea?
Well, Studs, who has since passed away, was a very close friend and a mentor and a hero to me. And he was this great oral historian and raconteur. He was nice enough. He must have been 91 or 92 at the time when we opened the booth, to come to Grand Central and cut the ribbon. And when he cut the ribbon, he said to us, we know who the architect of Grand Central Station was, but who is it who laid these floors, who built these walls? Those are the stories you must get through StoryCorps. And he kind of laid down the gauntlet. We've been fighting as best we can over the last 10 years to live up to that mandate and tell the stories of what Studs would call the et ceteras, all of us, the rest of us, regular people.
And a very important decision early on. The goal is not that you, Dave, or the other StoryCorps people interview those people. They kind of interview each other. Why is that important?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think what StoryCorps in the kind of the human connection and the wisdom business, I had, it's very early on from before StoryCorps started, we knew that this was going to be people talking to each other. And, I think it's an opportunity to sit with, and this gets to this book that just came out, which is about kind of honoring the people who are most important in your life. And I think what StoryCorps is an opportunity for us to take someone who really matters to us and bring them to this booth and have this conversation. You know, your cell phones are off, your computers are off, it's you and a loved one and a facilitator in this booth. And by asking them, who are you? how do you want to be remembered? What are the most important lessons you've learned in life? Telling that person how much you love them. You know, it's kind of, I've been thinking in the last couple of days, it's sort of the exact opposite of reality TV, because nobody comes to get rich, nobody comes to get famous. It's just it's an act of generosity. So that's been the idea from the beginning, and it's just worked in ways I never would have imagined. You know, when StoryCorps started, I envisioned it as a 10-year project. And so this would be, we'd be done now. But about a year into it, I saw, you know, the potential power of this very, very simple idea, and retired from making public radio documentaries, which I'd been happily doing for decades, to devote the rest of my life to this thing. So here we are.
Well, I want to get a taste of how this works. We've got some excerpts, some recordings of the excerpts that are in your book, Ties That Bind. The first one we'll play is Susan McClinton talking with her husband, Philip McClinton. Let's give a listen.
I came into the topless bar that you were bouncing to compete in amateur night because there was a prize at the end. And at the time, I had two children to support, so I needed the money. I remember at one point you said, I'll keep an eye on you.
I thought, she doesn't belong in here. She didn't need to be in this place.
And I think that was the beginning of our relationship. You said, I'm going to take you rattlesnake hunting. I thought you were absolutely out of your mind. But I had so much fun, I thought, hey, this is something I might want to do on a regular basis. And I remember at one point telling you that I had always enjoyed science in school. And you said, well, why don't we go back to school? And I said, you're crazy.
Neither one of us had anything but a ninth grade education. I'd tried 10th grade 3 times, and I couldn't cut it. And we didn't think anyone would take us. And I said, call them and ask. And they accepted us on probation. We took all of our courses together.
You didn't know anything about school. And I recall several times when you told me you just didn't think you could make it anymore. And I would always tell you, I'll get you through it.
And we were both working on biology degrees.
Remember cell biology? I drew a diagram and taped it up in the bathroom on the mirror. So in the mornings, you'd have to look and learn it from there.
Without your help, I'd have never gotten through this because a lot of it I just plain didn't understand. But I think the thing I'm proudest of is that you finally did things that you never dreamed you could do, and you did them so well. You turned into a fine field biologist.
I guess I learned for the first time that I really was a person of worth. You know, after my life started out so bumpy, never thought we'd get a college degree. And if you hadn't come into my life, I think I would have ended up in a very bad place.
Yeah.
It was a rescue romance is what we called it, because we saved each other.
Excerpt from Ties That Bind, a StoryCorps collection. Dave, is there something about being recorded and listened to and in, as you say, this quiet place without the phone on? Does it change the way we think about our lives?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, I listened to that clip, which is, I think, the first story in the book, where she says, you know, that relationship with her husband helped her realize she was a person of worth, you know, which speaks to what happens in the booth. And I do think that this act of being listened to tells people, that reminds people that their lives matter. And, you know, in many ways, you know, I think of, you know, in hospice, they have this saying that there, you know, there are five things that you want to say to someone before they die. And I thank you, I love you, forgive me, I forgive you, and finally, goodbye. And in many ways, you know, what happens in the StoryCorps booth is that you have the opportunity to say those things to someone while they're not in hospice, say it today and kind of have this sense of closure with someone and the sense that you're leaving something for history. So, I mean, every day of StoryCorps has been kind of a surprise and a miracle. And, you know, one of them is that we are a public service. So when you come to StoryCorps, at the end of the interview, if you don't sign a release, it doesn't go into the Library of Congress. You've had a great experience. You take the CD away. You put it in a safety deposit box. We couldn't be happier. And because of the intimacy of what was happening in these interviews in the early days, I thought we'd have a compliance rate of maybe 80%. And 50,000 interviews later, it's 99.9%.
Wow.
So everybody, you know, really wants to leave this record for the future. And I've also been amazed that, you know, when StoryCorps started, I had these fears of kind of Jerry Springer moments and people, you know, revealing things and trying to kill each other. And, you know, every single one of these 50,000 interviews has been done with grace. You know, I think if it's changed me in any way these 10 years, it's made me much more hopeful about who we are as Americans, about the people around us. The facilitators will always say when they come off the road, and their job is basically collecting the wisdom of humanity, and we've had hundreds of them now traveling the country, recording these stories, being present for these stories. And they'll all say, you know, if you ask them, what did you learn? They'll say that people are basically good. And I think when we were at 1,000 interviews or 5,000 or 10,000, you could say that it was it was a tainted pool of people who come to StoryCorps. But at 50,000 in all 50 states, it's 1,700 cities, and everybody across the political spectrum, every kind of person you can imagine, I think we're getting to the point where you can say there's some truth to that.
That's Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. His new book is Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. We'll hear the rest of that conversation in a few moments. And if you've got a favorite StoryCorps memory, head on over to the Central Time Facebook page and let us know what it is. We continue our conversation now with Dave Isay from StoryCorps. He has a new book out. It's called Ties That Bind. Dave, I want to give a listen to another story from the book. This is Lynn Weaver talking to his daughter, Kimberly Weaver, about his father, Ted. Here it is.
My father was everything to me. And it's actually kind of difficult talking about him without becoming very emotional. Up until, you know, he died, every decision I made, I'd always call him. And he would never tell me what to do, but he would always listen and say, well, what do you want to do? And he made me feel that I could do anything that I wanted to do. I can remember when we integrated the schools that there were many times when I was just scared. And I didn't think that I would survive. And I'd look up and he'd be there. And whenever I saw him, I knew that I was safe. You know, I always tell you that your mama is the smartest person I've ever met. But I think my father ranks right up there as brilliant. When I was in high school, I was taking algebra, and I was sitting at the kitchen table trying to do my homework. And I got frustrated and said, I just can't figure this out. So my father said, what's the problem? He came by. He said, what's the problem? And I said, that's just algebra. And he said, well, let me look at it. I said, Dad, they didn't even have algebra in your day. And I went to sleep. And around 4 o'clock that morning, he woke me up. He said, come on, son, get up. He set me at the kitchen table, and he taught me algebra. What he had done is sit up all night and read the algebra book. And then he explained the problems to me so I could do them and understand them. And to this day, I live my life trying to be half the man my father was, just half the man. And I would be a success if my children loved me half as much as I love my father.
A StoryCorps excerpt there. Dave, Lynn mentioned that he had a hard time talking about his dad without getting emotional. It's hard sometimes to listen to the stories without getting emotional. You really just get amazing emotional stories from the people who participate.
Yeah, well, it's not, you know, that's there. This is what happens in the booth. You know, I think of that story, and thank you for playing it. It's one that means a lot to me. I had the pleasure of meeting Lynn Weaver. His story was recorded as part of the GRIO initiative. We've had 9 huge national special initiatives. GRIO is our African-American initiative. GRIO is the West African word for storyteller. And I went down to the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta the month after we opened it to listen to stories back with families who'd recorded them, and Lynn was there. We played that story, and I got this email the day after that event where he writes, Mr. Isay, you'll never know how honored and touched I was by the playing of the remembrance of my dad. After I got home, I realized that the evening of the StoryCorps GRIO reception was the anniversary of my father's death.
Wow.
Even in death, he continues to embrace me with his love. Signed, Lynn Weaver, chairman of surgery, Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta. So, you know, Ted Weaver, who, as you said, was a janitor in Knoxville, Tennessee, who is the most important person in Lynn's life, who walks this walk and lives this life of you know, decency, brilliance, and honesty. You know, I think that when you hear a story like that, we're kind of walking on sacred ground. And I think that's why people get emotional when they listen to these stories, even when they're, you know, funny. Yeah. And to me, you know, Ted Weaver stands for so much of what StoryCorps is about, you know, that, you know, he's the kind of person we should be holding up to our kids as examples of who they can and should grow up to become and building statues to and so forth. There is no greater American hero. And, you know, and these stories are just hidden in plain sight all around us.
It's great that these are getting into the Library of Congress, because I can just imagine the social historians of the future using this as just this amazing treasure trove of stories and evidence and a taste of what life is like for us now and in the lives of the people that are talking there.
Absolutely. And I think even more so, I mean, the nature of what happens in these interviews is that it's a passing of wisdom. So in a way, what we're doing is kind of collecting, in some ways, collecting the wisdom of humanity. I think it's going to be very valuable. But even just the, you know, we hold half of our slots for people who might not have heard of us through public radio. We do hundreds of partnerships with nonprofits each year. So it could be people involved in the juvenile justice system or homeless folks who come to the booth in Paris to record their interviews. And I think that people who may feel like their voices aren't heard or their lives may not matter, knowing that indeed that's not true, and that their lives do matter, and that their story is important enough to be part of American history at the Library of Congress, can be very meaningful to people.
I want to listen to at least one more before we're done. This is Jenna Alperin. I think she's 12, and she's talking with her grandmother, MJ Seide.
Seide.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here it is.
How has your life been different than what you thought it was going to be?
I thought that my life was probably not one that was going to be worth living. There was this hole that I had all of my life because I never thought I'd be able to walk along the beach and hold somebody's hand because I'm gay. But, you know, when I fell in love with my mommy, I knew that she was my soulmate. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
I had never felt that way about anyone before. And after she had gotten her divorce from Grandpa Jim, she was very upfront with your mom. She told your mom she was in love, and it was with a woman. And that was the first time that anyone was proud to say that they loved me. That made me the happiest I'd ever been in my life. And then when I got to know your mom and Uncle Justin, I knew that I had hit paradise because I now have a family that I can wrap my arms around.
Is there anything that you've never told me but you want to tell me now?
You know, you and I talk about most things, but this is the first time that we've ever talked about the fact that I'm gay. And I guess what I want to ask you is, does it embarrass you to have a gay grandma?
No, it doesn't really matter because it just matters my relationship with you.
I always tell you how much I love you, but I don't know that you can really understand the depth of it because you're someone that I never thought would be in my life, and I can't imagine my life without you. You have always been a child that makes up her own mind, and I am so, so proud of you.
Well, you're one of my favorite grandmas. You do, like, a lot of things with me, like ride roller coasters and play poker. I don't know what life would be like without you here.
I love you, sweetheart.
Love you, too.
Wow. Well, I'd read that one. I hadn't listened. Much, definitely more powerful listening. So that's the thing, man. You're not just getting stories. You're getting moments by bringing people together like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see there and in so many of these stories that the microphone gives you the license. You know, as she said, we never talked about the fact that I'm gay,
yeah.
You know, and it gives them the license to have this conversation that they don't normally get to have. You know, I think of this quote from Mother Teresa, who used to say, "We've forgotten that we belong to each other." And this book, the Ties That Bind book, I hope does a little bit to help us remember.
So even if people don't do it with StoryCorps, and I know we've talked about this on the National Day of Listening shows, make the case for getting people, sitting them down and having these conversations and recording them.
Well, that's the easiest case in the whole world to make. You know, I did an interview, and I write about this in the book. I did an interview about 8 years ago with my dad, who obviously was a very important person in my life. And about a year ago, he was diagnosed with, the next day was diagnosed with cancer, and he was dead 9 days later. And, you know, it wasn't until 3 a.m. on the night that he died, listening to this interview for the first time, I'd never listened to it before, that the full, you know, the rubber kind of hit the road for me, and I fully understood what StoryCorps was about. And, none of us is, you know, we're, StoryCorps, I hope, reminds us to kind of, focus on what's really important and to tell the people who really matter to us now how much they mean to us. And doing these interviews, whether it's through StoryCorps, whether you do it yourself, or, you know, helping people listen to these stories or giving them the book, but especially doing the interviews, is something that you don't want to wait to do. It's really, you know, there are two things that I can guarantee from doing an interview like this. One is that no matter how well you know the person who you're interviewing, you're going to find out things you never knew. I was just, 10 minutes ago, someone else told me that. I mean, I hear that every day. And also, it's something you're just never going to regret.
That was Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. His new book is Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. There's a lot more coming up on this Christmas Eve edition of Central Time today. After the news, we'll hear from the practical archivist about the best ways to preserve and treasure those family photos, and maybe the best way to have a conversation about those photos, which ones are important and what they mean. Also coming up today, we'll talk with a philanthropist about how to maximize our year-end giving. And we'll revisit our conversation with journalist Sally Ohms. She wrote a book about the concept of home and what home means to different people. Also, stay tuned to us here on the Ideas Network after Central Time. We've got the Big River Radio Wave Holiday Special. Should be a lot of fun. It's a variety show. It's got artists like the Riverbenders, Kenny Solway, Al Ross, Ensemble Limousine, Twin Cities comedian Amber Preston, and more. That's coming up today after 6. You can get all of our latest show updates and get in touch with us on our social media incarnations. We're on Facebook. That is Central Time on WPR if you're going hunting for us there. And we're on Twitter. That's at Central Time WPR. If you're a Facebook person, by the way, we have kind of an unspoken goal. We'd love to hit 1,000 Facebook fans by the end of the year. We probably should have started begging a little sooner. I think we've got about 100 to go, but we'd love to have you there. We highlight some of our topics, get some conversations going on there, share pictures, and all that fun stuff you can do on Facebook. We've also got a hotline if you don't want to go online. We're at 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. If you have an idea for a topic or a guest for the show, that's a great place to leave it. If there's something you're curious about in Wisconsin, we've got a Curious Wisconsin segment that we're always looking for suggestions for. Love to hear from you there. Thanks again for spending Christmas Eve with us. Lots more to come on Central Time. And remember, we have some best of Central Time coming up tomorrow, Christmas Day, if you're listening to the radio then. Stick around. More to come on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret, and this is Central Time.